Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Okay, welcome everyone to the April 2025 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research, and here with the PCRF Journal Club, we take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. Big thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring to you the best of science in medical education. I'm Megan Corey. I'm here today with Alex Tremblay and Dr. Kim McKenna, and joining us soon, straight from the gym, will be Dr. Bill Toon. So today we're going to bring you an article that's published in the International Journal of Paramedicine, and this is entitled The Systematic Review of the Evidence for Using Simulation to Replace Clinical Experience. A very timely topic. We're looking forward to this discussion today. So thank you all for joining us today. And remember that if you happen to miss, where's my little cursor here? If you happen to miss, you can, any of our journal clubs, you can go to YouTube. You can look us up. We have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/@PCRF@UCLA. And you can see any of our past episodes, or if you have to leave early, you can catch this one. And remember, there's the clinical podcast, also Journal Club with Dr. Remley Crow, Dr. Tony Fernandez, a great group that happens the second Monday of every month. You can catch those as well. And remember, quote, tag, share, hashtag EMS research. We'd love to see us at PCRF at UCLA on any of your favorite social media platforms. So we're going to be talking about this great study. And remember, we're going to begin. We want to remind you that you can use the chat feature to post questions or discussion, and we can bring those comments into the conversation as we go. We'll be monitoring those. So a little bit of background. We know that there's been a lot of discussion. We've had a lot of discussion on this journal club about the use of simulation-based education to achieve competency in initial education programs, also for continuing competency and continuing education. So if you look back at some of those past podcasts, you'll see a lot of discussion about the various use of simulation and simulation-based education. So we've looked at comparisons of simulation-based education to traditional things like lecture, rote skills. We've looked at, most recently, we looked at the Aaron Donathan study, and we had Aaron on, looking at the use of virtual reality simulation versus traditional simulation. So even comparing different types of simulation and the impact on the learning outcomes. Usually it's competency, critical thinking skills, decision-making, and of course, those two words, I think Kim and National Registry, the clinical judgment, and that's what we're after now, the clinical judgment model, remember. So looking at the impact of using simulation as a technique, a teaching technique, and we always say simulation as a technique, not a technology, because the use of the word high-fidelity simulation sometimes gets confused with the technology when it's really a teaching technique. We also discuss research from other fields, medicine, nursing in particular, and higher education STEM research, and really on replacing work-based or clinical experience with simulation-based education, and in particular nursing. The Hayden study in 2015 was a large study that was, it was longitudinal. It was deep. It went all the way from initial training all the way through practice, so job placement and practice, and evaluating the replacement of clinical time with simulation-based education in different proportions. And I think in that study, they used 10%, 25%, and 50%. They might have used 75%. I can't remember. It's a study that's out there. You can look up. It's and found that there was really no difference in the outcome. And then there were certain more specific, more nuances about that though. And so some states have gone to allowing a particular amount of substitution in nursing programs of clinical experience with simulation-based education. And I will throw the caveat out there, the quality, and this paper is going to talk about that, and we'll talk about that. The high quality simulation is a very important piece of this. And I think nursing has done a tremendous job in this. We've got some evidence in, or some good guidance documents in EMS out there from NEMC, including a chapter in the textbook, the Foundation's textbook, and several papers, but position papers that have been put out by NEMC over the years. And also the COA EMSP, if you go to the website, coaemsp.org, and you look up simulation, there's a whole area on guiding document on the use of high quality simulation, what that means and what fidelity means and other things, some guiding documents for you out there. So I think it's important that this continues, but the evidence is what we're talking about today. And the glaring issue when it comes to pre-licensure initial paramedic education is there evidence for substituting simulation-based education for clinical experiences? So that's kind of the problem that they, well, the problem they want to address. The issue is to look at these, what's going on out there in terms of replacing. The problem they're trying to address is, and I'm going to, full disclosure, Kim and I are both on the board of directors of the COA EMSP. We and NEMC is my sponsors, my position, National Registry sponsors Kim. So we're involved in a number of areas in this, and we want to make sure everybody knows that. But I do have a program director hat. I am still a paramedic program director and can vouch for this problem as well as many of you probably can. There is a limited clinical capacity for paramedic students in the hospital settings, and in some areas. And that amounts to things that we have seen. If you're a site visitor out there, I know we're site visitors as well, and going around the country and seeing and talking to different programs and some of the data that have come out and a few of the research studies from the resource assessment surveys that come out of paramedic programs have shown a definite pattern of challenges in some of the clinical areas, in particular things like the OR, labor and delivery, and pediatrics, in particular the neonatal age group, in getting not just placements, but quality of the experience itself. And then I'm going to throw in there too, if you're a small program or you're in an area where the travel time for a student is, 50 miles or 100 miles or even greater to a clinical site, you want to make sure that experience is going to be worthwhile. So to have a student have to travel to a clinical site, that's a big deal. It's more than just ticking off hours and contacts. It's about the quality of the clinical experience. So we know that there are problems with this, with our clinicals. So the other thing I would throw in there is that some states have rules that surround, a minimum number of hours. And competency-based education, we don't really like to to throw hours out there, but we do know that there's going to be, some general features of a good quality experience. I don't know if that's ever really been defined, but you may have limitations on your program and say, well, my state says I have to have X number of hours. And so that puts pressure on programs to have to have these clinical experiences, and they may not actually result in good outcomes for the student or in any, qu good quality outcomes. So I'm wondering, have I missed anything, Kim or Alex, about, the problem here that they're trying to address?
Well,
Or
Megan,
anybody in the chat? I can't see the chat, so I don't know if people can see the chat.
sorry, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I just wanted to make sure that people know that the Hayden study, that they said that they were all trained, the faculty were all trained in simulation pedagogy. They had to all have adequate faculty to support student learners. They all had to have subject matter experts who conducted theory-based debriefing, and they had to have adequate equipment and supplies to create a realistic environment. And so I think, you can't
Kim is on the road, so we're losing a little bit of her of the signal there, but I know exactly where you're headed, Kim. We trying to compare this to that, and we caught the beginning part, the most important part of what you were saying, Kim, which was the faculty preparation. When they ran that study, it was a really tightly run study. So I strongly recommend 2015 Hayden. I can't remember what journal it's in, but it's the NCASBN that ran it, the National Council of State Boards of Registered Nursing, and it's really well done, and all of the faculty were prepared ahead of time, so trained in simulation, good quality simulation. It would be like requiring everyone to have, a certification in healthcare simulation, and have a baseline of at least how to do a good pre-briefing, debriefing, run a simulation, that kind of thing before it was ever run. So that's a really important, distinction. So, if we were ever to consider this, which we should talk about this at the end here or during in EMS, that is something that definitely we should consider. So, the research question, though, that they're after is what is the current level of evidence? So, we've looked at other studies that have said, hey, let's look out there and see what kind of simulation is being used. But this has the what is the level of evidence and the quality of the studies that look specifically at substitution of clinical experience with simulation-based education. And this is specifically in pre-licensure paramedic education. So that was our primary research question. They had two others, and spoiler alert, they were not able to answer the two others, but these are good questions. What measures and outcomes did they use? And when they, if there were studies that looked at substitution with simulation-based education in place of clinicals, and what measures did they use to actually test the effectiveness of it, or the efficacy, and then was it clinically or statistically significant in those studies? And then, if the evidence supports it, what's the optimal ratio of simulation-based education to clinical experience? And ratio is important because in that Hayden study as well, nursing programs are not structured so that you have X number of hours, unless your state says you have to, of clinicals or clinical experiences. You have usually a state registered nursing, a board, and that may define that, but the ratio was what they looked at. So that was how they controlled for variability in hours across nursing programs. So there's variability in all of these programs. There's just like there's variability in paramedic education, and we're kind of a newer field, and so maybe that variability is greater in paramedic education than it is in nursing, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. So, hey, I see Katie O'Connor's joining us. Katie O'Connor, are you actually here?
I know it's got a break from med school, and I was like, research, I'm coming.
Ah, this is
So
great. And simulation-based research. So this
I
is
know. The one thing I think that too is different when we think about the medicine versus nursing with hours and ratio is you can pretty much guarantee that a nursing student will see a patient in their clinical experience. But I think that sometimes we forget that paramedic experiences, you could go 24 hours or more without seeing a patient. So it's more like a lunch at the firehouse experience than a clinical one, right? So I think that's an important distinction too between the
Yeah,
two.
and that's actually an argument for hospital clinical as well, is the volume of patients that you see. But again, the challenges are out there, and the challenges with smaller programs too, and rural programs where, again, traveling 100 miles to a clinical, you want it to be a quality experience. You want them to get there and be greeted with, we don't like paramedic students. So it's an issue, and it's an issue we've got to really handle, rather than just commiserate about, I guess. So these were their questions. The only one they really get to is the first one. And Dr. Bill Toon is just joining us too. I hope you had a good workout, Bill. We're just getting started here looking at their research questions. And I did want to take a minute because we have Alex, and I like to take advantage of having a methodology person on here to go through the systematic review. The approach that they took to address their research question was to say, let's do a systematic review of the literature. And they use these two methods of checking. Can you help us with the choice of a systematic review? When would you say, I'm going to address my research question this way?
Systematic reviews are very hot right now in all research, public policy research, which is another area of research methodology that I'm very passionate about. A systematic review is very similar to a meta-analysis. Meta-analysis tend to be a little bit bigger. Sometimes you can kind of swap the terms out interchangeably. Here's the thing about systematic reviews and why they're so popular, especially right now, is that they have a very rigid set of standards. It's very easy to do research using like a Prisma checklist, which is what they used here, that says here are the things you have to do to have a successful systematic review. They look really good to journal editorial boards, right? And ultimately, what you're trying to do is take research that has either been done prior to your time or research that's well accepted, like Dr. McKenna's paper that's heavily referenced here, and find enough similarities to draw new conclusions. So instead of saying we need 150,000 people to do this survey or to do this study, we have three different papers of 50,000 people that have similar enough methodology using the Prisma checklist to make this a statistically valid report based on those methodologies. In this particular case, they're looking at level of evidence, right? So what did the paper give us for level of evidence? They found two of the papers to be level 4B, one paper to be level 5. So either expert commentary or high level of statistical rigor. And so that's kind of the advantage of a systematic review, right? Is accessing data that previously exists to form similar conclusions across multiple papers. The biggest disadvantage, right, is that there are things that are not published in data sets that cannot be accounted for. And that's why they also used the JBI methodology, which includes inter-rater reliability, which means Megan, Katie, and I would all review the same paper. And if our conclusions were drawn to be similar, we would feel that we identified the paper successfully.
So when you have a research question, what helps you say, you know, this makes sense? I mean, their research question was what level of evidence? So I think it kind of says, okay, a systematic review. We also hear of, oh my gosh, I just left my brain. What's the other review that includes gray paper, you know, all the gray literature and scoping review.
Yep. So which is when one do you... step down in the level of evidence.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They were definitely after rigor then. They were after good quality research, right? So is a risk then that you may miss studies out there?
I think so. I mean, you saw that I think it's on like the middle page, like page 4 or page 5 here, when they used their Boolean search, which they listed here, which is really nice. So you could do this. When they used their Boolean search, they came up with 1,596 papers plus 4 independent pages, which would be like brief research reports or appendices documents. And they took 17. Now, that means that they were really sure that they had really good research. They made sure that the paper made sense and they didn't just throw a bunch of stuff into a pot and call it soup, right? But one of the disadvantages to doing a systematic review is you got to go through a ton of papers and really make sure that you're answering the question that you seek to answer. And there's a chance that they missed some in here, either unintentionally because of the Boolean search or because they felt that the research question was just a hair too far off of what they were looking to answer.
Yeah. The rigor that they were applying, this is like evidence that of a comparison of substitution, not just, you know, comparing two different types of simulation or traditional methods to simulation. It was a substitution and not comparing clinicals to simulation. It was substitution of clinicals with simulation-based education. So that's a very specific research question to look at, but a super important one and very timely, right? This is, so I thought that was really good about this. So can you then walk us through, this is table 1, and these are the search terms, so you're getting at that, and the results that they get. So if you're, if you, me and Katie and Kim are doing this, and Bill in his retirement, what are we, you know, what are we doing? Is, do we divide the workload? Somebody's doing that. Do we both do search term, you know, these searches? You know, how do you usually do it if you run a systematic review?
Usually one person does the poll. Here's all 40 articles I found, brings them to the group. And then you have to do inter-rater reliability, which they did here, which is good. That means that of the 40 papers, maybe five of them, everybody reads and offers feedback based on preset criteria. That criteria might be, you know, the statistical methodology. Did you all identify the statistical methodology the same way? Did you identify the research question the same way? If you all agree on that sample of papers, in this case, they, I think they started with 28. So, you know, 3 to 5 papers total, then each person can independently review the remaining papers. Okay. You don't need to kind of do it together. This, I will say that inter-rater reliability and systematic review is how a lot of your protocols and guidelines are written for your ambulance services, right? Especially ones that maybe you don't have an expert, you know, you work in an area that doesn't have a big tox program. Your quality office, your medical directors are pulling a bunch of papers and working together with other medical directors to make those decisions. And that's really what a systematic review is. That's less formal than what happened in this paper, but it's something that you're doing all the time anyway.
The important thing for people that are out there that are just becoming researchers is that all of this is done ahead of time, right? Your question is out there ahead of time. Your search terms and everything are developed ahead of time. Can they evolve, or is that introducing,
I think so,
bias?
I think so, but that likely does introduce bias, right? If like we started with our research question of can simulation replace clinicals, right? And you get through 100 papers, and instead what you get to is like, can simulation support clinicals, or can simulation support X skill? With this big of an analysis, they likely did not have to pivot.
Yeah.
But with others, you certainly will see a pivot. And again, you have to remember that the paper that you read, this is a great paper. IJP is an excellent journal. There are not excellent journals out there too. The paper that you read ultimately omits the things that didn't go well, unless the purpose of the hypothesis is to tell you that something went poorly, right? So there's a chance that their research question was very different when they started. I don't get the sense that this was the case.
No, but I don't think so either. It's so specific, because you just threw out a couple of other research questions. One of the things I saw in LinkedIn when, you know, this announcement went out, is somebody had posted, which I appreciate, you know, that this is not, you know, we shouldn't be talking about replacement. We should talk about enhancement. You were talking about augmentation. I know Pat Tritt talks about this a lot too. Let's talk about it as an augmenter, not just a replacer, which I think is a great thing too. So that's a different research question than they had here. They were specifically looking at substitution. The Hayden study looked at substitution and impact on outcomes from pre-licensure nursing all the way to practice and across the country. So they had, that was a very specific question. That is another question though, is does enhancing, and if you add that to it, you might get more here, probably not a lot, but I know there have been a few that have looked at, and I'm not even sure if they were published research or if they were abstracts, looking at using things like virtual reality simulation and during certain phases of paramedic training and the length of time that it took to reach competency. So, you know, there's little nuances here, small studies out there.
It's important to know too, Megan, that this is whole text search. So they looked for any of these words anywhere in the paper, right? So that's likely why they got trimmed way down. I was just reading their methodology. This, they did not look just for title text. This was anywhere in the paper these terms appeared. So they're going to pull a ton of articles.
Yeah. And that's probably good, right? So you're getting a big pool, and then you're, of course, it's a lot of work. So we just said that systematic reviews, you know, it's an easy way, but meaning it's not simple to do the research, but it's an easy way to address your research question. If your research question is, where's the evidence?
You generally just don't have to develop your own statistics. That's really the biggest thing.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so the other thing I have here, and maybe you or Katie can answer this too, is this systematic reviews. How much has artificial intelligence, you know, ChatGPT and others, assisted with, helped, enhanced the, you know, reduce the difficulty of systematic reviews or searches of the literature or anything. Have you any comments on that or knowledge about that?
Not directly.
Yeah.
Not my experience.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, the use of artificial intelligence here. Katie, have you?
I can say I use artificial intelligence probably every single day at medical school. Yeah, and it's really helpful when there's like you have a whole slew of things and you need to kind of go from big to little, right? Mm-hmm. But then you have to kind of check. And the one thing I've noticed is when I'm looking for like a specific question of, hey, who's done research on this or where can I find these resources, sometimes ChatGPT will make up a lovely sounding citation and doesn't exist. So yeah. It does create like these are great research questions someone should answer. So yikes. There's definitely that thing that's still there, the whole hallucination. So maybe you can use it as like a jumping point to like things we should research sometimes.
Yes. We're going to have a whole bunch of research on that now too, on that itself. So Alex, can you walk us through this? This is that Prisma flow diagram. And we see this a lot in systematic reviews. So at the top, we're seeing.
Yeah. So at the top, we're seeing what they ultimately pulled themselves, right? So we saw on the last page, they got about 1700 total articles. They picked 40, 12 from databases and 12 from hand count. 11 of them are duplicates. They pull those out. They ultimately screen 29 records. 21 of them are excluded. Their exclusion criteria is not super well listed, but presumably it's once they really read it, it didn't meet the criteria that they were looking for, either based on the academic rigor or the documentation, or it didn't quite answer the question they were looking to ask or support the question. They ultimately get 8 reports. That's usually going to the author and saying, can we see your data set or can we see your additional documentation, your original submission, whatever. If there's no measurement in replacement, they pull them out, and that's kind of where we land for 3. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the steps that often ends up being the hardest is this report sought for retrieval. Like if an author isn't around, they aren't doing that research anymore, they did it at a different university and the university kept their proprietary data, it can be hard to go get that data.
Yeah. So, yeah. And they used a prior, there was one, this study itself is sort of an update of a systematic review because they do reference a prior study that kind of did a look at the landscape of research. Boghossian, I think in 2019, and a few of them. So again, building on prior research is what they were doing here too. So this is they come up with these 3 studies, and it just so happens one of these is the super study. So we've talked about the super study for a long time. Kim and I were talking about this. Kim is the primary author here of the super study, which is the simulation use in paramedic education research, a descriptive study. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, that I remember the super study as, and I can't believe it's been 10 years, that it was, you know, sort of all encompassing, was a larger study that looked at what is being used out there in paramedic. And I do remember distinctly that there was a lot of, you know, high fidelity, meaning high technology mannequins, what they were defining as fidelity, but high technology mannequins in boxes and people not, you know, familiar with using them. So a lot of it gets to that sort of training issue. But there were 3 studies that were pulled, and here, this table shows you the characteristics of the studies. And the first one was a super study. Another one was out of Australia in 2009, Williams. And then the third one is Kimberly Witten Chung's research out of 2023, which is, and Kim couldn't be here today, but Kim Witten Chung couldn't be here. But if you've ever met her, she's a dynamic person with a research background, interest, and NEMSI symposium. We usually see each other at NEMSI symposium. So you can capture her, you know, personally and hear about her research. And this is, these are the 3 studies. So, and all of the characteristics. So they're showing you the author and the origin, the sample, the design, cross-sectional mixed methods, cross-sectional survey, qualitative survey and interview, the methods or the measures that they used. Kim, I didn't even realize, I don't know if you can hear me, I know Kim's traveling, but that you based the census survey on the NCSBN survey and interviews. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, I know it's 10 years ago, dust off the...
raise your hand if I start getting fuzzy.
Okay.
So we use that, their research as sort of a foundation to say, what should we ask? But then we tried to relate it to EMS and the sort of the questions that we wanted answers. For example, you know, replacing clinical and field, or clinical or field, or replacing just skills was really important for us to know. And we also wanted to know more about interprofessional education as well, which was a sort of a separate paper.
Great. So a couple of the things that you see in their results was related to, again, the replacement of skills, or replacing the clinical experience with simulation. It was more about skills. That was one of the things that was the focus. And then 23% never used simulation to replace clinical or field skills. 66% said they never replaced clinical hours, and 77% never replaced field internship hours, which is interesting that it's 77%. I expected that actually to be higher in the field internship. And then the commonality, and we see this again, kind of across at least two of the studies, was that when there was a replacement of the skill, there was definitely a pattern. And I think we see this kind of anecdotally when we go around the country and we look at, site visits, and also and resource surveys and other feedback from paramedic programs. The program director, there's a feedback, or there's a work group now that's run through the COA EMSP, where program directors provide some feedback. And we definitely hear sort of patterns. And of the 10 skills that are identified for replacement, it was pediatric intubation was the most frequent one. So a lot of them were focused on high acuity, low frequency, things where the opportunities to get to that high level clinical judgment, decision making, team leadership are very limited. And so that, you know, I think people are doing this because it makes sense. And now we just haven't looked at sort of the evidence to whether or not, you know, that it's a combination of clinical and simulation, or whether the simulation, pure simulation. So I'm going to use an example, and then maybe Katie, you can, you know, comment, or Bill, about just what you think about this. So newborn resuscitation is one of them. Newborn and neonatal resuscitation is one of those areas that it's very difficult to get a paramedic student to actually get the hands-on experience in a clinical setting. But is it still valuable to be the fly on the wall and watch how a newborn is delivered, how the newborn management occurs, what they look like, how, you know, the midwife, nurses, physicians handle the newborn with specific, you know, emphasis on what they should be looking for, and then supplement that with taking them into the simulation lab and actually requiring the team leadership and the clinical judgment that goes with it and the demonstration of skill. You know, is that going to be the ideal piece? That because they're, you know, it's going to be a rare thing that they get in the field, but the expectation is high that they're going to know how to do something. So I'm curious what you think about that. I'll just pull Katie.
Yeah. You know, I think this conversation is really similar to one we have, like, we're thinking about clinical skills, clinical behavior and judgment, but we have the same conversation we're thinking of, like, gaining knowledge. Is a flipped classroom better than, like, a traditional classroom? And all those studies kind of say, well, it's really the educator that makes the difference. And I think that's going to be the same thing here, right? Because you could have really terrible simulation and it could be done really awfully, but you could have amazing simulation, right? And the same could be true. I know probably everyone on this call has, like, a memory of a really great clinical experience with a really great preceptor that shaped their practice. So I think that we have a problem there, right? With, like, the quality that we're comparing to. But I also think that, like, being a good bystander and, like, learning from watching is a skill. So I almost think that, like, we know from simulation research, Megan can probably quote the exact people, that watching a sim happen, you get the same learning value as participating as, like, the team leader in the sim. So if we did that, if we had students in simulation as the watchers, they could learn that skill translated to the clinical setting where they could take the same value from watching that baby being born. But I do think that there's a skill, like, to be an engaged bystander and, like, looking and seeing and observing in a way that you can take something back from that, especially that reflection piece, which I do think, like, especially this, like, post-COVID education group is really struggling with the reflection and, like, the self-work, which is what we're seeing in the education literature. So just thinking about that as a skill, and, like, how we can actually train that in sim so that their clinical experience could be maximized, and then, you know, the sim experience could be maximized.
Yeah. And two things are kind of popping into my head as you're talking. One is the training. We're talking about the training of the educator, the simulationist, the person who is understanding how that, where the simulation, you know, what the purpose is, what the objectives are, and then how to debrief, properly pre-brief and debrief to get the most learning out of the student. And the other thing is the training of the preceptors. So that's another thing is, you know, in the end, we've got the preceptors at the end there. And this kind of leads to what outcomes are we looking at? We don't have in EMS, and I think we've talked about this here, you know, on this podcast, and we've looked at studies in the medical literature, but we don't have EPAs. We don't have entrustable professional activities. I think they're out there, and maybe you're familiar with them, Katie, in medical school. You have to have, you know, the 13 core EPAs before you get to residency. And those, each of those EPAs is branch off into competencies, groups of competencies. So if you had an EPA that said you must be able to manage a critical patient airway problem, and that's an EPA to be before you get to your capstone field internship, then you have a whole series of competencies that goes underneath that. And those competencies lead to an entrustable professional activity, something that says, okay, I trust that this person can manage a critical airway before they go on their capstone. And those competencies, you know, all again, feed into that one EPA. And that's how it is in the medical field, in medical education. We talked about that on this, you know, education research podcast before. So that's kind of one thing. And that's, you know, how are we looking at those outcomes? And then we have to train the preceptors to be, and the educators along that pathway. And I don't know, Bill Toon, I'm wondering if you have some insight for us, because you're always saying EMS education is done on the cheap, but it's also, you know, the training of educators is also done on the cheap. And I don't mean funding wise, I mean just in general, with attention toward it. I don't know, Bill Toon, if you had any input on that, since you're always talking about that. No, Bill may not be here. Just his name, just in name. Okay. So, Kim, we talk about those EPAs before, and I'm wondering, you know, if that came up for you when you were reading this article, looking at, so we don't have any evidence for substitution right now. We have a lack of evidence, and that's sort of the conclusion of the paper, is that we have an absence of evidence that supports the use of simulation-based education to replace clinicals, and that research is needed. But we have, what do we have to evaluate the student's initial competency, you know, in the clinicals and in simulation, you know, to know what the outcome should be?
Well, we don't actually, well, we, as you know, we don't have any entrustable professional activities defined yet for EMS.
Yeah.
We have the SMC, but that doesn't really sort of pull everything together in the way that EPAs do.
No, but the and I would say, I think we have the pieces of them out there, but we have to pull them together. We have the practice analysis from the National Registry. We have the National Education Standards, and which are worded a lot more broadly. And then we have the student minimum competencies. So on all of those, you know, there's these dotted lines connecting all of them. And I think there's something in there. that for the to develop kind of these professional activities out of it. But again, it does come back to the training of the educators and in how to in what we want, first of all, you know, out of this, the graduates, and then what, you know, how to measure it, how to evaluate it and be consistent. So, okay, so the other thing that they saw was, quote, conditional support for the use of simulation-based education to replace clinical experiences. And that was meaning conditional support, meaning if they, when they asked, and this is mostly in the Kimberly Witten Chung article. Hey, Bill, oh, you're back. I don't know if we lost you for a second there, but yeah, Kimberly Witten Chung's article talked a lot about, you know, the use of the support for the simulation-based education to replace clinicals, but only in certain settings, if it was targeted and if it was high quality simulation. By targeted, I mean the high acuity, low frequency, the need for it, if there's a demonstrated need to actually develop competency in certain areas, such as pediatric intubation as a skill, but really more pediatric airway management. See, I would think of it as in a broader sense, or management of a newborn or a neonate in a neonatal critical care scenario. So Bill, earlier I had asked about educators and how to attack these, the training and background in educators. And you always say EMS education is done on the cheap. And by cheap, sometimes it's money, but sometimes it's also done on the cheap, meaning you've got a shoulder injury, I'll put you in the training center to do education. What are your thoughts that?
Well, before we get to that, I do want to talk about something that Katie touched on. And I believe observation can be an excellent educational tool. And I particularly like it when it can be a mentor can actually be providing the feedback live to the student as they're watching this particular procedure being done. And again, I'll draw back on personal experiences when we had the good fortune of taking our paramedics, not students, but paramedics into the operating room. And if the paramedic wasn't going to manage the airway for whatever reason, I would stay with them and we would observe the clinicians doing the airway. And then I could talk to them about, notice how they position the head. Notice how the mask seal is. Look at how their fingers, they're not white knuckled. They're gently hold, you know, so I think there's a lot to be said with observation if you can help structure it for them. But just observation for the sake of observation, they may not be paying attention to the correct the correct need. Now getting back to what you're saying about educators in general, I continue to think that we have an opportunity through all of everything we're doing in EMS, we can look towards making it better than it was in the past. And again, this research helps us begin to look at that. And I do think that we need to, I believe there would be value in enhancing the standards to become an educator. And I think there's a difference between the person who's teaching in the classroom, running a skill session, and or administrating a program. There are different skill sets for each of those. But if we talk about the person who is running the flip classroom or teaching a small scenario group or anything like that, I think that we absolutely do need to have higher expectations of them. Think about it, that someone needs a minimum of a four-year education, needs to obtain a teaching certificate just to teach kindergartner. Mm-hmm. And yet we take people with a high school diploma, the same level of certification they're teaching that may or may not come with field experience. And we are having them teach in some cases critical life-saving skills. There seems to be a big disconnect there. And I think that we need to, if we want to improve the profession, we need to improve the educators. I don't know what the right mix is for that, but I do think we have a disconnect for that. And I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. And I think I'm gonna add a little razor edge to that and say I think there's a general lack of respect for what it for education and preparation for to be an educator. It's when we just throw people in and say, well, you can do this because you've been an expert in the industry, doesn't necessarily mean they know how to teach it, right? And they know how to bring that out in the student, bring out the best in the student, or even create the best environment for learning. And that's sort of number one, is creating the best environment so that the student is capable of showing their best, and learn their best.
I
Alex?
think just to expand on what Dr. Toon said, and I agree that I think we have to set, a standard of some kind. Or I bet, first of all, I bet if we were to survey every EMS education program in the US, we would probably see that the credentials of educators are all pretty similar, or are especially in bigger programs, right? I mean, but the other thing I wanted to mention, kind of in terms of education, and especially like prioritizing simulation and education, we have to convince paramedic preceptors, EMT preceptors, field training officers that this is good too. So I had continuing ed last night. We did NRP. NRP is great, right? But one of the conversations that came up is like, we've got a lot of new EMTs that are coming in that have maybe seen one real patient and they did the rest of it on simulation. They don't know what to do. It's not true that they don't know what to do because they passed the same test that we all had to pass at one time. Maybe it was on a computer instead of on paper, but it's still the same test, right? And they still had to demonstrate those core competencies. And there's a reason for things like COAMSP to say, yes, these are programs that are meeting the core goals of paramedic education, higher learning commissions, things like that. One of, I think, the biggest challenges is going to be convincing those folks that take students out on the truck that just because it was not, you saw it on a call yesterday, is not, does not mean it was not a valid training and learning experience.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of goes with, there's a lot of comments in the chat, and I'm actually able to pull it up. Hopefully it's not blocking anybody's screen or anything. But Dr. Heather Davis is in here. Jaime Flores is in here with some great comments about existing evidence and also about some of the challenges. So the simulation, they're talking about the first of all, Jaime Flores is talking about simulation is a methodology, not a technique. And we use the term technique, not a technology, because they both begin with T and it sounds better. But but yes, it's a methodology, a teaching methodology. But the definition of it varies too. And that's why that one study was included here, that middle, the Williams study in 2009, which some people would say that's not simulation, they watch videos. But the interaction with the video, and this gets to that observation. And this also gets to what is role play? Is role play simulating? Role play is really important. Let's say you want to do an exercise on breaking bad news. Do you need to have all the bells and whistles of what people think of as a large scale simulation of, start from the radio call in, here's a door sign, go in, do all of this stuff. And part of, and the competency that you're looking for is the ability to do a death notification. Or can you target that and do role play? Give them the tools of the research background on what is a good, what has been demonstrated as the best way to deliver breaking bad news or to give a death notification, and then have them role play. This is that a better way to do that? Is that simulation? It certainly isn't lecture. So that's the thing that we were getting at too, is I think there's a lot of misunderstanding of what simulation is. And Jaime gets at that too, saying that there are institutions that are saying that they mistakenly perceive simulation as purchasing advanced technologies, exactly, rather than not understanding it's a methodology. It doesn't rely necessarily on on technology. Completely agree. And then lots of great references in here, simulation, the article itself to the super study, and then Dr. Davis saying the EPAs, the 13 EPAs, you can actually look them up really easily online, but Dr. Davis actually put them in here in the chat. And we aren't far off. We just have not pulled them together as EPAs and put them front and center. And I think that would be really helpful to kind of reframe the narrative about what it takes to be, what we expect, what we trust that this student will be able to do either before they get to their capstone or before they get out there. So lots of great stuff going on in here. Thanks for putting all these links to other articles in the chat. So, and if you want to, if you're out there, you can visit the chat. You got a couple of links coming up. So, Katie?
Again. Yeah, when you say that we're like not that far off there, and I just, I'm thinking too, like, especially looking at this slide here, like absence of evidence supporting it, but we actually do have it. I think we just haven't pulled it together, right? Because COA requires, at least on the paramedic level, all paramedic programs to say like when they allow simulation for some specific skills, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, California, we know that they're allowing simulation for pediatric intubation because you can't do pediatric intubation in most places in California, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty much across the board. So we have that. The COA is collecting all of this data, and they also have the outcome data, right? Because we also have, as paramedic programs, have to report on outcomes. And then I know like Alex has all the data on QA fallouts from his programs. And so we have all this information. It's just, we're not pulling it together, right?
Yeah,
so
in a research.
Using it.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think that's a really great point. And I think some of it, we've been focused a lot on compiling a lot of things in those resource surveys and again, reporting out numbers, but that you're absolutely right. There's the data are there, and it's more about reframing the question and maybe looking at a longer term outcome too. Dr. Davis says something about probably, and I don't know if you can, Stephanie, can we bring Heather into this? Because you've got a lot of great stuff in here that's just being typed, and I don't want to just read off. If you're able to
bring her in, hold on 1 second.
That'd be great. And I thought of you, Heather, when I was reading this article. I thought EPAs, you know, this is really, even though they don't mention it in here, that's all I could think of is we're you know, looking at competency. It would be really, you know, cool to see something like that in EMS, and you being in the assessment area in medical education at medical schools, that would be, you know, that it's be a great topic to have a chat about. But you said probably should have the word clinicians, not paramedics, likely important skills for pre-hospital clinicians at any level. Yeah, and there's a lot of research on EPAs in EMS or in emergency medicine as well. Is Heather on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Thanks for joining us. You had so many comments in here, I figured let's bring you in.
Sure. I was just correcting my own sort of misspeak when I said, mm-hmm. I probably should have said clinicians and not just at the paramedic level, because if you look at those EPAs and you think about what we're asking any of our providers at any level to do, or any of our clinicians at any level, whether they're EMTs or intermediates or paramedics, I mean, when we ask them to do a history or a physical exam or give a handover report, I mean, so many of those EPAs, maybe not every single one of them, but many of them would be appropriate at any level. And it's the activities or the behaviors beneath those entrustable activities, yeah, that would be at the appropriate level. And so, like you said, when we sort of get together as a community and decide what are the, to Kim's point, what are the activities that are currently being performed in the student matrix of competencies, how would we sort of put those underneath there? Mm-hmm. Again, I don't think that we're thinking about new or different in many cases. It's just the way that we have, this is just a framework for organizing what is already happening. And in many ways might be an easier way to pull all of that information together, especially if we think about the continuum of education or a systematic assessment of the learner from the classroom and the lab and the sim and clinical and field internship and capstone, and sort of thinking about all the way, and for those who are able to, even onto their professional activities once they are licensed through the EMR and those. We got close when we were asking how much prompting is required. And if you recall, mm-hmm. from the 2016, when we were thinking about the integrated out of hospital documents, that set of documents from National Registry actually asked at the top of the field form how much prompting is required, and that's how you decided if you were going to, yes, give the learner a 1, 2, or a 3. And it didn't, you know, it's, that was the framing. And entrustability is very similar, the way that they ask, like, how much supervision did this learner require? Did you have to, did they basically just watch you? Did you have to intervene? Were you like right there, totally jumping in and having to intervene? Or were you basically the guide on the side? Or could you walk away, come back, and it would have been fine? And in our context, it would be like, could you be in the other room if it was a confined space? You know, those calls where the patient's in the bathroom, and could you have been in the hallway and it would have been totally fine? What's your sense of entrustability? Did you trust the learner would have been totally fine? And I think we indeed are very close. It's a framework, and then socializing that framework for organizing things that we already ask our preceptors and our educators to do.
I think you can also already see where entrustable professional activities could help us, because we hear the common thing. Well, we have a student that that hits all their competency, meaning they've checked everything off, they've got their hours, but we really don't think they're ready. And a lot of times they're in that affective or communications area, and there's a whole EPA on it being, you know, interprofessional communication, on transfer reports. I mean, there's a whole thing about being able to hand over a report. There are things that are missing. And I think they surround that kind of, you know, being able to connect these things. And I think an EPA can actually help that, because then it forces us to sort of design tools that will help us evaluate students like that.
Documentation was another place that we hear, even things around like timeliness and responding to emails or communication to the preceptor or the school, showing up. Many of those professional behaviors do get captured in the EPA framework because it's an assessment for, in this case, it was designed as an assessment for residency, which is the transition of learner to employee, also still learning, but employee, which becomes an HR nightmare if the learner is not ready. So we think about this as well, where we transition from, you know, supervision to a lot of autonomy in the back of that ambulance or on scene with a patient. And that's, we want to be thinking about that too.
I think that gets to the comments you hear from preceptors about, well, I just can't put my finger on it, but I don't think the person's ready. They need a little more time. It's not about, I think our focus has been on the list of skills. And if you look even at the SMC, it's very technical. It's very much focused on the technical and the experiences with different types of patients. But there are those other things in the EPAs that, like you said, the focus on documentation and on communication, and I think those are things that it could really help our industry and our educational folks out there, preceptors, program directors, you know, clinicians or educators, if we had some more focus on these are the things we want to be able to trust that they will be able to do, surrounding things like handover, good handover reports, and that kind of thing. So,
In the last comment, in the one of the things that we're always struggling with is time, and in the volume of learners that we had at UCLA, that total the SMC was 14,000 different skills and scenarios. It was a lot. So time is an issue. But if we think about the papers, the work of like McGahey and his colleagues, we can be more efficient if we were doing like deliberate practice. And they've demonstrated that they can take what used to take a year to train fellows in invasive procedures and get it down to a month. So if we were using those sorts of frameworks for better education, we might find the time that we're looking for without the extension of time for programs that none of us are going to get. None of us are getting more time or more money to do any of the things that we do.
No, exactly. And you just hit on like little notes that I have on the side, you know, that we know, and this is sort of a problem in our field too. We already know that good simulation-based education and interactive learning is much better than lecture, poorly run labs or simulations. That spacing, retrieval practice, deliberate practice are educational, you know, practices that are much better for student outcomes and for retention and long-term retention. So we've got to start with those, you know, we've got to start there too and ensure that our educators are all, you know, able to understand what is the best practices in education and to stop falling back on, I didn't have time to prepare, so I'm just going to lecture for 3 hours. So that's still goes on. I'm sure it goes on at all levels, but it's, that's a good starting point before, and then getting to simulate, best practices in simulation. The other thing I wanted to ask you about really quickly, because we're at the top of the hour, is we've got to battle culture a little bit here too. So how do we combat the culture of, and they mentioned this in the paper, that culture is going to be a barrier of, this is how we do it if we don't have these skill sheets. And I know when there was panic when National Register said we're pulling this off the website, and there was panic at the EMT level. Where's the skill sheets? We need the skill sheets. You have to have the skill sheets. There's a lot of misinterpretation that these are required things and they're gone. So how do we, overcome culture?
Well, in this case, I would say don't look at medical education, because there's been four major sort of initiatives throughout the last 100 years of medical education and very little change. We're very reliant still on the traditional method of just sit through school, then go to the hospital, just follow people around and hopefully it'll sink in. So we have these pockets of excellence, but we don't really have a widespread, change. So don't look at medicine. What we know about change management is relationships matter. And so helping manage the emotional component. This is something that we did battle at registry, is when we were thinking about the change in the psychomotor exam, is we didn't understand at first how attached emotionally people were to the exam, that they really felt strongly that I had to go through this hurdle, so everybody else should, that this was a rite of passage. And so we did sort of need to think about relationship management and how we get people there. It is rarely with research articles and more information and bonking people on the head with the science. And we know that, we saw that in COVID, and we see that continue today. And so think about where we have champions who can, move initiatives forward where people trust that person and will follow them. And I say work where you get traction. If you get one cohort, the Tuesday night group, and people like to be part of something that is successful. So something bigger than themselves. And so that idea of work where you get traction, and then we can move a mountain forward.
Great. What a great way to end this. And thank you all for joining us. We went a little bit over, but so worth it. And thank you, Dr. Davis, for joining us also. So don't forget, we are going to be back next month. Our next Education Research Journal Club, though, is a week later than usual. So write this down if you're going to join us online. And it's at a different time, because we are going to be live from AccreditCon in Anaheim, California. It'll be Friday, May 30th. We're going to do a little lunch and learn for about 45 minutes or so in between sessions. It's at 12:15 p.m. Pacific time. I can't do the calculation right now, so you're going to have to do it if you're at another time. But we'll have that up for you. Stephanie will. She's smarter than I am. And then the next PCRF Journal Club, the clinical one, is on Monday, May 12th. And that will be with Dr. Remley Claro, Dr. Tony Fernandez, Michael Caduceus, and others. And remember to join us live each month. You can register at prehospitalcare.org, and you can check out our YouTube channel and subscribe. And you can even go back and listen to this one again. I think I am, so I can hear Dr. Davis again. All right. Thank you, everyone. We will see you May 30th. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.